Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Orakang Earthlets, and welcome to the latest episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. I am your host, as always, Mark Shah. On this episode, we're talking to an artist who's been working for 2000 AD for a number of years now. To my shame, we've not had him on the podcast before, but it's Lee Carter, who's the artist on the new series of Angelic, which is beginning now in the Judge Dredd magazine. Lee's worked on various things: Judge Dredd, Indigo Prime, Durham Red, Rogue Trooper. It was great to chat to him about his career, well, for many reasons, but one of them is that his path has been the opposite of the journey that many artists that we've interviewed on this podcast have taken, whereas they have quite often gone from working in comics to working in games. Lee has gone from working in games to working in comics, but it's accompanied by a lifelong love of 2000 AD. So it was super to be able to have a chat with him. The quality of the audio isn't brilliant, but we've tried to tidy it up as much as we can. So apologies if you have difficulty hearing. We are rapidly heading towards the end of this year. Next year, of course, is 2000 AD's 45th anniversary. You may well have already seen some of the announcements about books that we've got coming out next year. Stay tuned for more announcements from the Galaxy's Greatest Comic. And without much further ado, let's crack on with our chat with the artist on Angelic and Indigo Prime and Judge Dredd, Lee Carter. So how have you been coping with the pandemic? Because I read an interview with you a while back that mentioned about how the freelance life suits you, because you basically get to just be on your own. But of course, that's been enforced.
Oh yeah,
more recently.
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange one. I've not noticed it personally, but apart from obviously the entire family being at home. So it's a bit. So I've had the two teenagers at home, last year anyway, they've all gone off now. But obviously work shut down for everybody, so my partner was at home, and then the two teenagers. So yeah, it was a bit of a change, obviously, people coming and going. That solitude had gone. But yeah, you just work around the noise. It's like driving for a screaming two-year-old. It's just going to plow through.
Brilliant. I mean, I, to my shame, I realised I hadn't had you on the show before. Because we've been through since the podcast started, we've been through Indigo Prime, we've been through Angelic. So with the new series of Angelic starting, it seemed like the perfect opportunity to actually have a proper chat. But tell me a little bit about yourself. Because I mean, just before we started, mentioning, you know, you're Hartlepool, born and bred. Is that right?
Born and bred, yeah. So well, I was born 1974, Hartlepool. but yeah, I'm normal Hartlepool lad. My parents were quite young, so they were, I think, 16, 17 when they had me.
Wow.
So hats off to them. I've got two brothers and we've all been to university and did it. We're all doing stuff we enjoy. So obviously having young parents, I didn't affect anything. Apart from it was quite fun, I suppose. But yeah, the usual growing up, it's an industrial town, Hartlepool, but it's a lovely town as well. It's got a lovely beach. I had like 5 minutes from a big swimming pool. So it was quite an idyllic childhood, but I was shitting outside until I was 10, because we had outside toilets, which is a strange thing to explain to the kids, that like, yeah, you had to go outside to go to the toilets. But no, it was good sort of childhood, if you know what I mean. It was 2000 AD, obviously kicking out a big part of the childhood. But yeah, just a normal growing up. I say I was the only child, because I was 17 before my next brother was born. So I basically had the childhood to myself, and my parents to myself until I was 17, by which point I was going off and doing my own thing. So Yeah, but it's weird. I'm old enough to be both my brother's dad. And I'm actually older than
in, in Hartlepool terms, certainly, is by the sound of it.
Stranger.
Say again?
My poor mother, I think she was collecting their family support for 45 years. Always taking kids to school.
Wait, let's just talk about the influence of 2000 AD on you as a kid, because you know, you described this idyllic childhood. You 2000 AD, when people first discover it, particularly if they discover it when they're kids, there seems to be this range of experiences of it. You know, that for some people it's all of a sudden like a third eye opens and they can see colours they couldn't see before. What was it like for you? What was the impact of for you?
So that was definitely the case. I watched you put the video cast things. I loved them. Great job, by the way. I really enjoyed it. Yeah. But like a lot of the arts who said it, I think we've all got a very similar sort of thing. I mean, I went from dinosaur books and nature books to horror books. And you're just searching for imagery, constantly looking for stuff. Because obviously, way before the internet. So if you want to find a dragon, like literally hope there was a book about dragons somewhere in the library. Or I mean, so I think I'd gone from being bought annuals as a kid, like the Beano and Wizarding Chips and the rest of the sort of Shivering Shape. So I was a big reader. I think what had happened is I got a few Judge Dredd annual, maybe a Kickstarter. I think it was 50 pence, so it was after the Christmas sales. I think I picked it up. So it was quite nice to discover that. And then I think it was around issue 390 that I became an avid sort of constantly every week buying it. And then obviously bought all the back issues as a kid, going backwards and forwards to different newsagents to find, like last week, so a month before. But yeah, you find them all weird little places. I remember I bought the Fest 100 or something for a penny each in some flea market. So yeah, I was just literally out to find anything I could possibly find 2000 AD related. There wasn't, in terms of comic shops, there wasn't much in Hartlepool. So there was only a few market stalls and stuff like that. You could go and pick up your comics. For me, you get your 2000 AD from most music. So that was quite a... But that was the weekly comics were still quite everywhere, but DC and Marvel were quite hard to come across. But yeah, I remember completely what I was talking about. Where were we again?
it's that act of having to hunt for something. Do you think that was very much that kind of it solidified a relationship with this thing, that it wasn't just that you enjoyed reading it, but it was your thing, you know?
Yeah, it was very much a search. I mean, we used to get the bus across to Middlesbrough, and I remember my friend took me to a game shop. We used to sell like the little Citadel miniatures way before. I think probably around the time Games Workshop was doing the board games with Judge Dredd as well, I think. It was around 83, 82, was it? So I think I started reading probably about 84, and that's when we searched for 2000 AD stuff. But this game shop sold the Titan reprints. So they had all the Judge Child and I was like, who's Judge Child? Who's that? And they're all on the top shelf. So it made them different, more prestigious than the sort of flimsy paper sort of comics that I'd been used to reading. And I think it was like, so I'd read Asterix and I've read stuff from Tintin, as I obviously get from the library, every school library, stuff like them. But these, the Titan books, were just like, whoa. And that's Brian Bolland's crisp artwork and stuff like that. The Bill Sienkiewicz covers, like it was something completely different. So, yeah, I think that was on my Christmas list for the next 5 years or something, Titan reprints. And I'm not quite sure when the Eagle reprint started, but I remember picking a few of those up.
The American size ones.
They
began in 1983,
1984, around then. So I was picking just a few of those up. I remember the Think Angel, the one for Think Angel on the cover. I think that must have been your first one, the Brian Bullen cover as well. And that they were nice. Yeah, I remember them being. It was basically after, so from 390, it was a case of catching up with War of Mist. So I had like 10 years of stuff to catch up on. as well as basically being a bit of a sort of a wrecked everything I could possibly find. I bought the board game, I bought the role playing game, just to copy the artwork, I think, was more than anything.
I might be jumping the gun a little bit on this question, because obviously we'll talk more about your style and how you do comics in a bit. But do you see or do you think that your style is basically grounded in that moment? These early influences that have continued through.
Definitely, 2008 most definitely. That was, as a teenager, that was the constant weekly dose. I mean, I was picking up DC and Marvel, but that was a bit more of a trek for me to go and try and find them. But 2008 art-wise, at that point, I think it was Brian Talbot was doing the ABC Warriors. Hell Trekkers was running. I'm a huge fan of Steve Dillon. City of the Damned, I think, was one of the best Dread stories that really sort of hooked us. But yeah, I was going back to, obviously I went to art college and stuff, and it was all more Sean Phillips and Chris Weston and Simon Bisley, more of a modern artist. When I think when I first started picking up 2008, it was Steve Dillon and Brett Ewins, Brian Talbot. And you go back and discover Brian Boland and Mike McMahon and stuff like that. So yeah, it was just like a treasure trove of discovery backwards and forwards, if you know what I mean. The new stuff coming out to discover and then the old stuff to discover. Yeah, it was, but yeah, my star, I think my style was very much, people say it isn't different to 2008, but it's weird because I believe I've learned to draw through 2008, which is a strange thing. Probably doesn't come across as much, I suppose.
Well, I don't know, when I read an interview with you where you mentioned about Brian Talbot's Nemesis, I can see that in your work, just particularly, and again, we'll come on to this in a bit, but your environments, your backgrounds, you know, the kind of wider angled shot, there seems to it feels like there is a direct influence there. But we'll talk about that in a bit. But one thing I did want to ask about, because you know, you went to school, you went to university, etc. But it's funny that you mentioned you've listened to previous episodes before, because of course I've interviewed lots of people who started at 2008 and went into computer games. But you went the other way. You went into computer games and then have come to 2008. Tell us a bit about that journey, about how you...
It was
Bizarre Creations, wasn't it?
Bizarre Creations, yeah, for a good 13 years, but it was an awesome time. I think what had happened is I did illustration as a degree. So I was purely traditional artist. I was doing watercolours, mixed media type stuff. And I finished my degree, and I was really lucky, so I could start to pick up work. I got bits of work. So this was in 96, 97-ish. So I started picking up publishing work. I used to just go to the Smiths and pick up the magazines that I thought might hire me. But I was going to the comic conventions as well at the same time as Jock. So I'd met Jock, and we were both going to the conventions, all four of us. And I think what had happened is that I'd literally had about a year's worth of work. I was doing stuff for Spine Killer magazine. I'm not sure if you remember that one. It was like a kids' magazine. I'd advert and stuff. I think Paul Johnson made them. So there's a few 2008 artists did like a Goosebumps kids' horror story type stuff. But I did it for about five of those after I finished university. And they were really well paid. I think it might have been Hatchet Publishing, maybe, or Eagle Moss. I can't remember now. I did stuff for Arcane Roleplaying Magazine, which was Future Publishing as well, I think. I did quite a few illustrations for them. And I'd been to a few of the UCAC comic conventions, and I always had a great sort of coming back for sample scripts to do. I think I'd met Dave Bishop. He gave me a sample script to do. So it was I never quite got past the three pages, doing three pages, send back. I had this real bad sort of stoppage. I couldn't break three pages before I'd want to be doing something else. And I think what had happened is my parents, I think, decided to go off traveling to India or Morocco or somewhere, and they were going to sell the guest house. I used to live in a guest house in Hartlepool, but they ran. we were going to sell the guest house and go off travelling. And I'd sort of gone back after university. It was that weird stage where I should be getting on with life. So I thought, I need to do something. I've always been into computer games. And I could see adverts with jobs for concept artists coming up. So it was like a new industry. And I thought, well, I'll give it a go. And I think I tried. There was a 2008 artist called Ashley Saunders. He did a few episodes for Lawman of the Future. He did the Michelin Men episodes, if you remember that. Very similar to Brett Ewing.
Yeah.
So I went to college with Ashley, and he was working at Sony at the time, I think in Liverpool. And there was a job advertising coming for Liverpool. 2D artist was needed. And so I phoned Ashley up and said, is that at your place where you work in the job? And he's like, oh, no, but it might be across the road at Bizarre Creations, which is in the same technology. I'm really bad at mispronouncing words. Technology part. So he passed me over to Bizarre Creations, who's the boss, Martin Chudley. He was a huge 2008 fan. And so he'd seen my work, his drawings, and said, let's get him in for the interview anyway. And so I basically went from doing illustrations, publishing, and got a job at Bizarre Creations on the merits of a few sort of drawings I've done. But I never touched a computer at that point, so literally. But I think it was at the time the industry was literally needing artists to come and join, because it was massively expanding. I think I was the 21st employee at Bizarre Creations. I think it was over 260 of us by the time it was finished. So, yeah, I went from a very small company to a massive company. But you know, obviously, is it Rodney Matthews, the artist? I'm not sure if you know him. 70s sort of fantasy artist. He did the logo. It was like a pumpkin head, like wings, like a pumpkin dude with wings. That was a Bizarre Creation.
Oh, okay.
That was cool. He came to the office once. But yeah, I went to college and university too. Ashley Saunders was at college with us. He ended up going into computer games. And if you're listening, Ashley, say hello. I've lost contact with Ashley. It'd be lovely to say hello. Sorry. but yeah, Ben Oliver, I went to university with. Warwick Johnson Cadwell and Fred Blunt as well was there. He's a really fantastic kids illustrator. But yeah, there's a few comic book artists I've met along the way. Sort of journey to becoming a comic artist. But yeah, Ben's only down the 5-10 minutes down the road. So, and Dave Kendall's only along the 20 minutes up the road. There's a few of us in Bristol. But yeah, it's nice.
you do tend to get these little knots of creators, you know, you get like the Totnes Mafia with like Jock.
And
there's a knot around Bristol. There's one down on the south coast around Eastbourne and Brighton, and it's lovely.
I thought, yeah, Rob Williams had just been across the air.
We don't talk about him. when you're at Bizarre Creations, I'm curious as to, because as I said, we know from experience on this podcast what comic creators can bring to computer game firms. When they make the move across to the industry, but I'm interested what you learned for comics from working on computer games. What skills you picked up? What you think it did to the way that you draw?
Yeah, I think it definitely was. I think it added a lot to me. Where I think it became quite, like you said about Brian Talbot stuff, quite interested in the actual environment that the people are in. And make everything quite consistent. I've always been like Tintin and stuff with that, but that was a consistent environment with the people. And I think working with computer games has sort of made me more aware of lighting, environments, and literally where people are stood. I don't know, a lot of things really, and obviously using Photoshop, which is something I'd never touched previously before. So I'd literally learned to paint for years and years and years, and then had to forget about that, and then we'd learn how to do what I was doing in paint in Photoshop. So that was quite a strange learning curve. The 3D elements as well, which I probably wouldn't have touched if I hadn't been in computer games, learning to build something for reference sake. So using the computer more as a tool for reference than it people say computer rendered, I wouldn't technically say it was computer, like computer rendering to me is when you have a team of artists selecting materials and then they press a button at some point and then it sets the renderer off, which makes it all nice, do you know what I mean? Whereas I don't really use that side of things. So I wouldn't build the Lawmaster and then press render and then make it all shiny and new. But I would build the Lawmaster and take screen grab and then trace over the top and redraw it, basically. So yeah, I take the computer thing so far, but not as far as you could take it if you really wanted to, in terms of rendering out things. So my colouring now is basically, it's all flat colours, and literally the rendering I do is in the shading, which is hand-shaded. It's all hand-done. It's just done on the screen instead. But yeah, it did help, I think, a lot. ZBrush as well is another great tool for modelling faces and stuff and creating creatures that you can rotate around and just see what they look like from different angles. And so yeah, I still do bits of games.
Well, because it's always interesting seeing how different artists have incorporated things like 3D elements into their work, you know, whether it's at a sort of planning stage or penciling stage or something like that. But I just, it's more whether, you know, it provides something a bit deeper than just straightforward techniques, you know, whether because do you feel that because you're thinking much more about the overall look of something. You know, not just character design, but also environments, also, you know, the structure of things other than human beings. Do you think that comes through in your comic work from games?
Well, I think it's all about consistency, I think. But for me at the minute, it's like, so if I'm drawing a page and I'm using the environment, I want that environment to be the same the next page. Whereas I found my use of paint was too inconsistent. You painting is very random, and you can work with mistakes, and you can go places you never thought I'd go. Whereas I think working with the computer colouring side of things, more the drawing's just drawn. I think drawing's drawn, whether it's on paper or on the screen. The colouring is definitely a bit more thought about. It's hard actually to think about how it's. Because I think I've always been more of a comic artist than a games artist. Which is a strange, because obviously I was in games for a long time. But I was doing a lot of concept stuff, 2D stuff as well. So the 3D part of it was sort of left for professionals. I was doing bits of the simpler 3D elements of things.
What were the games you were working on? You worked on when you were at Bizarre.
So we did a lot of driving games at first, which was quite hard for me to get into because obviously I have no interest in cars whatsoever. The company Bizarre Creations made its name on a Formula One game on PlayStation. But I think Martin, being a fan, he wanted to put me in a cupboard and let me do what I wanted to do for a bit. So he had me just in the background doing bits and pieces. But then eventually, after a few driving games, I think he did Project Gotham Race on the Xbox. Metropolis Street Racer, the Dreamcast. There was a game called Blair, which is James Bond Bloodstone. I did a game called The Club, which I was quite hands-on designing the characters and environment for that. That was a safe game. That was really good, actually. I don't know if you've seen a game called Geometry Wars. It was quite big in the gaming world. I've lost all of that worth of the world now. Games we do. Yeah, majority driving games. Treasure Planet, the Disney game. Yeah, quite a few over the years. I said it was a bit more of a driving game studio. But The Club, James Bond, Fair Fighters, if I remember that one. But I think Project Gotham has just had a 20th anniversary, which made me go a bit crazy. Like, God, I'm a retro gamer now. But I did some work last year, the year before, for Peaky Blinders, a game they released the game for Peaky Blinders, and I did a load of the sort of cutscene elements and the cover the game and loads of the character type stuff. That was a lot different to what I normally do. Yeah, that was good fun. I've just did some texturing in the week. Textured some balls, which is a strange one. But that was fun, nice little change. Just a few monster heads that could wrap. So it was like a UV that could wrap onto a ball. So you've got to draw it flat. And then obviously it's going to warp and fit the ball. So that was quite good fun to see where that would go. But yeah, weird little bits and pieces of computer game jobs still pop up now and again. So.
Let's talk about the transition from games to comics, because you were at Bizarre Creations for what did you say, 13 years?
Yeah, so basically I had a word of boss and said, because we were doing so many driving games, is there a chance in the evenings I can draw for comics? And he said yes, no problem whatsoever. So there's a big transitional period where I was working until 7 o'clock at night, going home, play with the kids for 2 or 3 hours until it was their bedtime, 9:30, 9, and then I'd come back and go straight back to work. And I think that went on for about 3 years. I think working until like 4 o'clock in the morning, so sort of as a second job. But that made the transition a lot easier for when we all got made redundant eventually. But it made it my going freelance a lot easier because it already, I think it was literally just in time for me first Judge Dredd, the screen one. So yeah, it was literally got made redundant and then just continued doing the comic strip stuff during the day, rather than in the evenings. But still do them in the evenings as well. They're just all day now. Just continued. So yeah, it was quite an easy transition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was going to be my next question, whether it was something that, you know, had some false dawns, whether you felt, you know, it's quite easy to slip into the industry. Because I guess ultimately, in that situation, you go in and like, well, I can clearly draw.
Yeah.
I clearly know my way around, the programs that you use and the way to just draw a human being, I guess. But was there a time, were there any times when you looked at the kind of work you were getting and thought, this might not work?
Mr. Stuffins. Have you ever heard of that one?
Mr. Stuffins?
Mr. Stuffins, that was a straight. I did a few stints for Boom Studios, a few little shorts for Boom Studios when I first started. Stuff like Cthulhu Tales. I think I did one called Pirate Tales. But they offered me a four-issue miniseries called Mr. Stuffins about a robotic teddy bear with a sort of secret agent persona knocking on for a little kid. But I just couldn't quite see how, because at the time it was all quite dark stuff I was doing. I was like, Necrophilm maybe was on at the time, or before. But I'd been doing some Games Workshop. It was all dark and gritty. Black Library, sorry. But I couldn't understand where this Mr. Stuffins had come from. But they offered me the job, and I think I did the first issue. And this was on top of my day job as well, and I couldn't continue for the second and third and fourth. I just couldn't quite understand where I was fitting. It was like a kid's story, but it was like Ted, but it was way before Ted, but not the same sort of humour as Ted.
Yeah,
where it didn't have any humour.
The Seth MacFarlane. Was it Seth MacFarlane?
That's right, yeah. So like a talking teddy bear, like wise cracks and stuff like that. But yeah, I just couldn't. I think it was probably more to do with working a full-time day job and then trying to do a four-issue miniseries. It's probably a bit too much, which is a shame, really. I think somebody else read the entire thing. Yeah. But it was just bad because the first issue had gone out. I never hired me again. Lesson learned. Don't jump off yet.
was being made redundant a blessing, do you think? Did it kind of finally push you to pursue things?
It did, yeah. I mean, not for everybody else. It was like a family to us then, because I've been there so long. And a lot of us obviously grew up, and we had kids. The kids grew up, and it was a really nice company to work for. And I probably would have been there a long time if we hadn't have been pushed. But yeah, I mean, it worked out well, because the partner decided to go to university, so it meant we could pick the university that you wanted to go to. rather than being stuck in a... So being freelance meant that we could live anywhere we wanted to. Whereas we started chasing jobs and like game development, no idea where you'd end up, especially with kids and stuff. So we settled in living in North Yorkshire, between Scarborough and York we lived. Sort of beautiful Georgian house. So yeah, once we'd moved from Liverpool, once redundancy had happened, we moved up to North Yorkshire. My partner to go to university for about 5 years there. So yeah, it was lovely living in the countryside. But yeah, it's nice. I completely forgot where I was going now.
But is it, you know, do you think if that hadn't occurred, you would have had the confidence to have gone and pursued comic books? Or would have always been in the background?
I think I probably would eventually have gone full time freelance. Just because I think it changed as well, because going from a small team of 21. To people where you know everybody, and as I said, the company got bigger and bigger, and it was 256 or whatever. You sort of you do disappear, or you, sort of the changes a bit, the sort of company itself. So it became a bit more of a job than it was sort of a nice place where it was always a job, but obviously, that sort of small knit of people have grew into a massive group of people. Which obviously, when you get more people, you get more clicks. And it's sort of, rather than just being about everybody, became, yeah, I'm not sure. Who knows? It depends what games they were doing as well. I'm sure I couldn't handle the driving game. It's like it's always been about what's fun to draw for me. If it's fun to draw, I enjoy it, and you'll see the work that'll come through in the drawing, I think. So yeah, I think if we had another 4 years of making car games, I probably would have jumped, probably. Yeah, Bond was fun. We've got to design some cool Bond baddies and draw a few nice storyboards and stuff. So.
You contributed to Event Horizon, which was Liam Sharp's self-published anthology title, which I remember at the time. Yeah, loving what was there, but I think there were what, two issues, and before
that's
it was,
right, yeah,
before it was cancelled. But it very much felt like a, and Liam might kill me for saying this, but like a renaissance from the 90s. So you know, beautifully rendered, you know, kind of epic story, epic artwork to the stories. So yeah, it felt like a. Throwback's the wrong word, but it felt like it was that period again. How did you fit into this? How did you come to be working for Event Horizon?
So I think I joined a message board. It was Liam Sharp on Liam Sharp's message board. There was only a handful of people on there. Dave Kendall, Kev Crosley, Emily as well. There was a few other ones. But it was a very small message board there. It was at the time the internet was people start post-work up. And then I think Liam decided to do an anthology of sorts and brought loads of people in, like Chris Weston, Steve Nye. There was quite a lot of people on, actually, wasn't there? People were already in the industry, and then a few of us newcomers from the message board got a chance to do a few strips. I think I did a strip called Necromashiach. Nothing to do with Necrofilm. The few Necro titles keep popping up. Necromashiach, where Liam Sharp actually wrote the story of Arthur as well. I did three of them in the end. Third was never published, didn't do the third book. But it was nice going to the conventions, like the first time as a sort of guest. In Bristol, the first one launched. I remember signing it, and I think it was Brendan McCarthy may have walked past. And I'd signed it, but not realised who it was. And I could have had a little fun moment there, chatting to him. But I was sitting there, I bumped into Brian Boland the other week. That was fucking, yeah, that was really nice. In a comic shop in Glastonbury. It's a very small world.
Oh, right.
Bizarrely, yeah. Me and my son, we were just going for a wander around Glastonbury, about 40 minutes from here. We wandered around Glastonbury Tor, talking about Camelot 3000 and Brian Boland and King Arthur being buried underneath. And then we potted into town, went to the comic shop, And I could hear a gentleman chatting about Silver Age comics. And then I think the chap behind the counter said, oh, didn't you draw Starro? And I just clicked straight away who it was. And then sort of fumbled, hello, Brian Boland. And tried to make it easy, but I said, I'm an Arkoid too. Okay. But yeah, it was nice. I'd have a little chat. But yeah, Big Hero as a grown up and stuff. But it was lovely. It was a really nice weekend. Nice surprise for the weekend.
That's, I guess that's one of the coincidences that you'd expect from going to somewhere like Glastonbury, surely.
It's like weird magic, wasn't it? The last time I went, there was people fighting in the street, so there was a lot of difference.
I've heard that about Glastonbury.
That was funny, yeah, it was really funny. Yeah. I think it was three separate fights going on. It was really like, just, like some weird karma, some weird vibe. But, yeah.
I'm interested in this moment when you've done stuff for Boom, you've done Event Horizon with Liam, and you've mentioned stuff for Wizards of the Coast, things
yeah,
like that.
Imagine FX as well.
Imagine FX, yeah.
Yeah.
With the transition to 2000 AD, was this something that just came out of the blue? Was it had you pitched to Matt or how did that come about?
Oh, right. So how did that happen? I think you may have seen the Necromachia stuff from Event Horizon. But I think the first one was Bad Blood, which was the Arthur Waite story, the vampire one. That was the first job I got. How did that come about? I don't know. I must have met him at a convention. And then it must be a year or so, but I think I've been doing bits of other things. We made things, imagine, I don't know. I have no idea how that first connection came.
Because that was 2007, I believe.
Right, yeah, so... Yeah, it must have been, that's after Event Horizon, isn't it? That's all I can think of, we've seen Event Horizon, and I may have contacted them. But I've been in touch with Dave Bishop. And I go three pages into the Sinister Dex story, which was all hand-painted as well. I ended up with a job of Bizarre Creation, so I never actually sent it in the end. And I met Axel Alonso as well in the UCAC comic conventions. And he sent me scripts to do for the Weird War Tales. Never sent them back, which was a shame. But yeah, I'm not sure how Matt contacted us. It must have been something to do with Event Horizon, I'm sure. And been at the conventions and stuff. But yeah, I must have sent them work over the years. But yeah, I think it was a nice surprise to see it being 2008 last. But yeah, that was
because that fairly quickly led on to Necrofim.
That's right, yeah.
The series with Tony Lee. Now, without going too much into it, Tony's time at 2000 AD is a mixed picture. But Necrofim is a series that let me double check. How many series were there, Necrofim?
Three series.
Three whole series. I mean, you know, from 1628 until 1723. So yeah, over the span of 100.
Definitely brought me three pages, Cherry. yeah, I thought it was great. You know, I mean. There's a few. I was doing like the telephone. I wasn't quite sure what was going on with the telephone. But I enjoyed the whole thing. I enjoyed drawing it. I enjoyed where it was going, the backstabbing, and who was going to be the betraying who next. But yeah, the whole thing, I quite enjoyed the experience. But I think the style was come from the stuff I'd been doing for Games Workshop and Event Horizon. That sort of black and white, scratchy pencil type stuff. Then I'd draw it and then scan it in and then stick it like a dark colour over something print it back out and then work back into it in pencils. And so yeah, it was a bit of a mess, technique-wise. But yeah, it survived. It's quite consistent, actually, when I look at it now. I think the second and third season were a bit better for the brightness levels. Pushed it a bit, and the reprint looked a lot better than the produced red magazine. I didn't notice that. But yeah, it's a shame for Tony because, as I say, it was a And I still get people now saying how much they really enjoyed it, which was obviously, there was a lot of bad stuff in the prog about it. But yeah, there still seems to be a few people out there who really, really enjoyed the artwork. And stuff, so. It'd be nice to do again in colour.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of questions I have about this, because there was a lot of talking heads.
Yeah.
In that series. I mean, for someone who, you know, and casting no aspersions, didn't have an awful lot of comic book experience at the time.
Yeah.
Was that a particular challenge?
No, because I think between the talking heads, there was cool bits you could get to do. There's a few quite still after, like Cerebus, the big dog. And there's quite a few big fight scenes towards the end. So I did pick up the talking heads. There was a lot of like people entering the scene, I noticed when I was drawing it. There was always someone entering a scene and then they'd be chatting and then there'd be somebody else entering the scene. But I enjoyed drawing monsters. Again, that was quite a fun one, actually, yeah.
It's one of those series where, certainly in terms of, like you said, the artwork was consistent throughout. You know, you had your style and you stuck to it all the way through. But what did you learn from doing that series? I mean, particularly over three books. I mean, that's not to be sniffed at. Were you finding it easier, or was it pretty much the same process as you were going on? Because I basically want to know, how did you keep it consistent while still learning from the process?
So, yeah, I think I kept the process the same all the way through. And that, actually, Nexus One was quite quick compared to like Angelic and Indigo Prime. Because I think Nexus One, I was just using the pencils that I'd done as the inks and just basically pushed up the contrast and then reworking it on the computer. So it was actually quite a quick technique. But what I found, I just loaded pieces of A4 with random panels on, just compiled them everywhere, and I just scan them all back in individually. That was using, whereas now I just draw on the screen now. I don't bother with the pencil. I don't even, it's like a combination between pencil and ink, and I do now. So I'm just drawing and inking as I'm drawn. So rather than doing the pencils and then inking over the top, I'm literally just drawn. So if it looks rough, I can just rub it out and draw it again. When obviously that's a bit slower. For some reason, pencils are quicker. There's no zoom with the pencils, so. But yeah, it was just. I think learned obviously Brighton and my palette. Learned a lot about going from the computer screen, which is all backlit and looks fine to me, and then obviously comes back in the printer, it's a lot darker. So I learned to press the brightness up at the end of the job. So when the job finishes, whack the brightness and contrast up and hope it'll work. But I think I forgot that in the last Angelic. There's a few pages that I've done of brightening up. But it looks great on my computer.
What interests me is that, you know, you've done something like Necrofin, which you know, like I said, was a fairly hefty chunk of work. But then you're continuing to do freelance work. You know, you're still working as a freelance illustrator, because you did stuff on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. So that must have been a long time after Necrofin. That was more towards Indigo Prime time, maybe. Because I was in North Yorkshire at the time. I was getting these weird jobs from a friend, David Forrest, with the Sunflower series, graphic novels with. And he was passing all these weird, cool jobs over to me, like bizarre stuff. Like, I think I designed some stuff for Gladiator 2, which was, I presume, some long-lost pitch that's gone on somewhere. One of them about the vampire in the lake. I saw Jennifer in the lake, which is an old 70s film, I think we're trying to remix. I was getting all these jobs to do bits of concept art from these pictures. The Teenage Mutant Turtles job literally came in at about 5 o'clock in the evening and said, can I get it done by the morning? And I think I did 3 frames by the next day. And they were like, we're just movie screens, and they'd keep all the characters on different layers so they could move them around. And I think we used a few of them on the intro for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. But yeah, that was a strange job. No idea how that came about, apart from obviously the friend David Forrest, Kinetic Forrest, maybe the company was called, was doing a fuck. But yeah, strange, cool though. I still haven't seen the film. I did watch the dodgy copy just to check to see if it used the credits. See, just so I wanted to tell people, obviously I wanted to make sure they'd used without to tell anyone. No, I didn't fancy all the pictures.
Well, your next big thing for 2080 was Dead Eyes.
Yeah.
Which we 2080 we've done this trick a couple of times, well, a few times, of starting a series and then it's revealed later on that that it's part of one of our main series. And of course, spoilers for those who haven't read Dead Eyes, do recommend it. But it was Indigo Prime.
Right, yeah.
And it was a way of leading into a new series of that. When you picked up the series, when you were given the job, was Matt and John upfront about what this was going to be?
I think the full script was already done, so I must have knew. I don't think I'd taken it in exactly what event it was. I remember Chris Weston's Indigo Prime. Big sort of inspiration at the time when it came out originally. But I never sort of realised there'd been such a long gap between. It's just, I didn't really think about that. It was cool that they were coming back. I think it was originally Lee Garbutt was originally supposed to be doing Dead Eyes. Because he had a bit of artwork in there from him originally, what he was going to do. So I presume the script was full done, so I must have knew about Indigo Prime being popping up at the end and kickstart a new thing, which I think it worked quite well. Obviously, Dead Eyes was quite. I did it purposely. I didn't overly drab it. I said, look bright on my screen, but I wanted to keep it quite MOD, Doctor Who, Lake District, that sort of wet England sort of dullness. And it works well when Edmund's artwork kicks off the Indigo Prime and sort of bright and colourful. It was almost like Wizard of Oz for me, that like this squaddy chap had been taken to this sort of new world, and then the next season was like really bright, and the universe opened up, or the multiverse opened up. So I thought it worked really well when you read Dead Eyes and then Indigo Prime. But obviously, Indigo, if you just read Dead Eyes, you might be quite depressed afterwards. It's quite dark.
Because Indigo Prime is one of those series that is by its very nature imaginative and you know, no holds barred, and I mean, you mentioned Chris Weston's work there on Killing Time, which is a personal favorite, but also Edmund Bagwell, dearly departed Edmund Bagwell, whose work on Anthropocalypse is just, you know, it's stunning, it's absolutely incredible. How did you feel sitting alongside this?
Well, I knew that when obviously the next part of Indigo Prime was, I had to really raise the game. Because, it was just obviously the astonishing stuff. Beautiful to look at. I had a sort of idea how he did it. So I knew he's obviously using some sort of not photo reference, but computer mannequins and stuff like that as well. So I thought, right, I can sort of try and mimic that a bit. I didn't work, I didn't care anyway, his work. But yeah, it was beautiful, the first, quite a hard act to follow, I think. But yeah, it made me up my game. I think Indigo, I do feel it was an upping of my game when Indigo Prime came out, which was obviously a lot better than the reception of the Necrophon was seen. So, but I think it was the added colour. Kicked off the story a bit more. Tough act to follow, really. Tough act.
Because that was one of the things I was going to ask about, was the colour. You'd done Necrophim, which was obviously in grayscale.
Yeah.
You'd done Dead Eyes, where you were downplaying the color scheme quite a lot. And then on Indigo Prime proper, a bit of a kaleidoscope going on there. Kind of coming back to what we were talking about before, had you developed a sense of color from working in games? Because what I noticed when looking at an awful lot of game concept artwork is often how not particularly colorful it is, you know, because you're having to fit into a world particularly if you're working on quote unquote realistic games or games set in the real world. Not everything's nice and bright, but this required, you know, big pops of color, big contrasts, quite wide vistas. Had you got a sense of how colorful you could go, or was it a bit of a challenge to go, no, I can throw this off. I can throw off the kind of monochrome and actually go nuts.
Yeah, I think a lot of the monotone stuff comes from lack of confidence to do full color, which bizarrely it shouldn't be. I was doing illustration for my degree. I was like a children's book illustration type stuff. So it was all colourful. Yeah, my degree work and maybe not so much my degree work, but I did the H&D as well. So the H&D work stuff I was doing, that was all really bright, colourful kid stuff. And I did a degree, which went a bit darker. So there's always interest in colour there. And even the concept art stuff, I mean, a lot of that was colour. And we did a lot of the sort of driving games to draw the cars and bright, colourful neon cities and stuff. So, I mean, there was colour in the portfolio. I think it was just necromachia Event Horizon led to, I think it was a weird thing of getting paid from Games Workshop to do illustrations in black and white. And so I developed a sort of crusty style in black and white. That led to necromachia, which led to Necrophilm. So I think it's one of those cases, if you do something, people think that's what you do, not realise you can do other stuff. I think that was just one of those things where I just flowed like that rather than... And then obviously doing the Indigo Prime, hopefully showed I could do colour as well. And that's been colour ever since. Which is obviously better, but more money, colour. So...
Moving on from Indigo Prime, I mean, you've done some... Rogue Trooper as well. That I think Guy Adams, was it?
Guy Adams, yeah, it was, yeah.
Let me double check before I...
That was like the weird Halloween special, wasn't it?
Yeah. Other artist.
Yeah, the colour was getting a lot better. Yeah, it was a lot better by that point. Because even the first season of Indigo Prime was still fine in the style. Because if you look... The first season of Indigo Prime compared to Angelic and the later seasons of Indigo Prime. I used to do like stuff like stick photographs in the background or on the characters as well and blend that into the rendering. And the stuff was far more rendered, like drawn. It was far more layers of wear gone into it. And the later ones where I just used flat colours. I got sick of I didn't like seeing photographs in the wear. I think where it was one of those things where the new Photoshop, of course, you're going to mix things up sometimes and experiment. I think I'd seen Ashley Wood was doing it, where he was mixed paintings of photographs. So I thought that was really cool. But I think by the end of Indigo Prime, I didn't like that job. I didn't like doing that anymore. No, it wasn't everywhere, but occasionally you'd see it. It didn't work again, consistency. It didn't work. Consistency-wise, seeing as something more rendered than another panel next to it. So I try and keep all the panels at a similar sort of rendering now, rather than getting really excited drawing a monster's face and going over the top on it. Just keep it all as simple as I can. Hopefully.
Because one thing that stood out to me, I mean, it was only one, I think it was like the 2014... summer special or something, but one thing that really stood out for me on your Rogue Trooper stuff was how you really ramped up the contrast, between this bright blue super soldier and then everything else was, it was quite, because, you know, previous artists had incorporated it, it either downplayed the skin tone or incorporated it more widely into the color scheme of the strip, but yours really popped out, and I thought that was quite interesting that you'd chosen to go down that route, because it's something that's, I guess, no one had really played with before.
Yeah,
he's bright blue.
Yeah, he's blue, isn't he? You don't get a chance to draw blue people. You make the most of it. I think the majority of the story was all set in his head as well, wasn't it? Because it was like a virus fever. So when that was open, I was like, shit, make him a bit brighter and the rest of the world a bit more. But yeah, I really enjoyed that strip. I enjoyed doing that one. And I felt at that point I was getting a bit more confident in the colour stuff and how to go about doing it without needing too much reference or too much photographic, so I still make it look nice. I quite enjoyed doing the job.
What role, if any, does 3D software play in your process?
I wouldn't say it's a mixed bag. I mean, I'll use reference from anything. So I'll use 3D models, I'll use photographs. I've even bought a few of those rubber mannequins, ones you can pose. And they're really rare. Because you can set them all up. You can get your pose, get your light right. So what I'll do is, I think I've seen Sean Phillips and Chris Weston do a similar thing. You set the page up with a series of bad reference shots. So I do my initial thumbnails, who I've got all sketched out. So I have an idea of what I want in the pan. And then, depending on what it is, how often I'm going to see it, if it's a room I'm going to see a lot, I may build the room in 3D. If it's just a one-off room I'm not going to see again, I might use a photographic reference, I might just draw it. So 3D is not something I use on everything. It's something that comes in handy for certain things. The same as where photography comes in handy for certain things, or then the mannequin toys come in handy. Obviously, I haven't got the physique of the mannequin dolls, so I can't do photographs. If I'm drawing a big muscly chap, I'm going to use a mannequin, or I might use a model of them and ZBrush or something. So I like to keep it all mixed, not rely on one thing, because things break as well. So my computer broke the other week. If you lose one program, that's your way. Gone. So you do need to find alternatives and not rely on 3D and not rely on photography. I can just draw it. I did a few strips that just literally drew my head, no reference. But for consistency, reference is key, I think. Unless you're drawing Tintin, when you can just draw something like simply cartoony type thing.
That kind of brings us on to talking about Angelic, because I find this series so fascinating, not just in what it does, not just in how it looks, but also people's reactions to it.
You wouldn't think people would be forgiven of it, but people have talked to it.
This is what I found fascinating about it, because the Angel Gang are so so beloved, to the point where, you know, as soon as Wagner killed them off, he was like, I've regretted doing that, so I'll just bring them back in various stages. Over time, you know, it's focused, all the attention is very much focused on Mean Machine, you know, in the 95 movie, there's been various stories. But then, you know, Angelic comes along, and not only does it look different, it's telling a familiar story, but in an unfamiliar way. And we had Gordon on years ago now, I think when the first series began, where he explained where he was coming from, and it was fascinating to hear. But, you know, do you want to explain a little bit about what Angelic is and the direction it's coming from on what everybody thinks they know about the Angel Gang?
I think it was Power Angel, or something interesting, the character, because he was one of the quieter characters in the Angel Gang. He didn't know that much about it. But I think it's the fact that the Gordons took it away from that sort of comedy aspect and created this sort of situation that's more of a... The word again. Well, Gordon's writers are awesome. I think Gordon writes really well. And yeah, it's just took it away from that two-dimensional aspect and just open up a bit more about what's made, what the Angel Gang could be. Because it's not the Angel Gang, really, is it? It's a different thing altogether. And I think the mistake I made is the last series, the season that's running, is I made the bad guy Judge Chin too big, so people mistook him for Dredd. I'm like, that's the Dredd. If it was Dredd, we'd be far more of a fuss made about the fact that it was Dredd. But I think I should have thought about that, changing him a bit more, looking back at it now. I think it's the environment they're in as well, isn't it? I must be finishing playing The Last of Us when that was first started, Angelic, hence the beard and stuff like that. I grew the beard for Angelic the last season, it's never gone. For reference. Yeah, I'm not quite sure, you know, why it's what it is. That's been a really enjoyable series. It's probably my favourite draw, actually. It's on the cast there. It's awesome.
Well, in terms of your design for it, it feels very much, I mean, this may be intentional, this may not, that you've complemented Gordon's take on the story, in that there are lots of visual cues,
yeah,
that we are dealing with the characters that we know, but at the same time, in an unfamiliar way, if you see what I mean, you know, even as something is revealed to us and the little cogs in the memory kind of click into place. Was that something that you intentionally did in the design for these characters?
Yeah, I think originally, I think even Fink slightly changed towards the end. He became a lot more Fink-like than he was when he first got introduced. He looked a bit more feral in the second season of Angelic. I'm not quite sure what happened there. Probably my fault for not looking back. Keep things consistent. Mean Angel obviously was a tough one to come to redesign and keep the same but not the same. Because some people can draw Mean Angel and he looks mean, and then some people draw more the simpler side of Mean, who was obviously the simple kid who's been transformed into a monster. I think even what Power Angel wears is pretty much what he wears in the original comics. He just needs a shave, which would have made him probably more par-like. I think I just kept it more serious and grounded and less crazy than... I kept hoping Gordon would chuck me some crazy stuff to draw with the grounded stuff. Like a giant dinosaur might pop up at some point. Did stick a few oddities in there, but I don't think, they haven't come across the same craziness that the original Angel Gang have come across. That maybe made them that way. So maybe a few more years, Angelic, you might end up.
the influence of Westerns on the creation of the Angel Gang, and not just Westerns, you know, general kind of hillbilly archetypes from America. If you look at the cursed earth that Pat Mills envisaged in The Cursed Earth in, what, 79? By the time The Judge Child comes along, it is much more of a Western, you know, a blasted desert landscape. And they kind of reflect that. So it's interesting to see in Angelic that, you know, it's kind of a full-on Western, as it were, you know, the kind of saloon bars and dusty canyons and all this, that, and the other. I'm presuming Gordon's directed that in the script.
I think it comes across. It's probably reading you've got all these tropes and stuff in your head mingling away, haven't you? Like, so I suppose reading the script, I was probably thinking like the way the world's been set up naturally already, from the likes of Missionary Man and the settlements and from the, obviously just the main strip. There was always that Western theme to it, which I presume the care set was so big. It'd be Western themed, and there'll be somewhere else. It'd be really odd. Somewhere else, it was big enough for everything. So this particular part of the care set is very Western, I think. Yeah, even for the design of the wagons, like the sort of the last season of the wagon, sort of you know, mining trucks and stuff. That was obviously came from the mining side of the Western genre. I think it's just there naturally when you're reading the script. It's obviously came through from the script, and that's the way it's being through. You can go really crazy, I suppose, when you think about it. But that care staff was actually quite out there, wasn't it? A lot of different landscapes.
Over the years, it's been everything to everyone, really, you know?
Yeah.
One minute it's got dinosaurs, and the next minute it's got, Munt's Farms and flying sharks and... And also, it's a big old space. I want to ask how you've changed over the course of this process, because this is what, the third, fourth story now?
Yeah, it's the third season, isn't it?
Go on, what you say?
I just thought there was a little pause there.
Oh, right, sorry.
Yes, I think it's the third season, isn't it? Yeah. What I'm most proud of Angelic is, again, the same word, consistency. Throughout the three books, I'll probably go back and, if they ever released Angelic as a graphic novel, I'd probably go back and fix some of the first season. But I think the second two series, I quite like the way I got the style and the technique, and so literally in this case of just following that through all the way through the story, keeping to that technique, which is basically draws, you know, line work, traditional line work, and then what I would do is just put a flat colour, and then I'd put that to the side, and I'd do the shading, and then put it all together at the end, and then that sort of things work. There's not much highlights. I don't put any highlights in painting. I'm not sure if you've noticed. So that's it. Once it's mid-tone, the flat tone, and it works. There's a bit of fiddling around at the end, but it's keeping it so I'm doing the same thing on each page rather than getting excited and going off and going crazy on each page of something different. I enjoyed Angelic.
I mean, is that a lesson that you learned from previous, where you thought, oh, I'll do this new technique, and then by the end you just
A lot of it's experimentation. It's like, you've got a nice, like, say if I built a spaceship, I've got the spaceship and it's referenced on the page. Now I can use the information from the computer program with all the nice light and the sparkly stuff, but I don't want that because that's going to look different to the rest of the pages. Because I haven't got the same amount of information that's going through for the rest of the drawings. So it's keeping the information on the drawings the same throughout, rather than going overboard on one particular panel and then not remembering how you did that as well, which used to be real. When I used to paint, I think, how did I do that? I've literally no idea how I've done the previous panel. So many layers of paint. You think, do that again the next. So yeah, painting must be really hard for people to do consistently. Keep it simple and then stay consistent.
Well, I was going to ask about speed, and you've commented in the past that you felt the need to be in a certain number of job. Oh, you there?
Oh, are you still there? Yeah, I'm there.
All right, okay.
A little power thing popped up.
you've commented in the past about you felt the need to do that there's a minimum number of pages you need to do a week, and so you've taken on jobs and sometimes have felt overwhelmed. But I'm wondering about how the changes in your style, your familiarity, and things like that, whether you've sped up over over time. No.
I keep trying to speed up, but I keep getting stuck in detail. I'm doing the job. I'm doing some workouts for 2030. What I'm trying to do now is draw an actual size rather than drawing bigger. Because normally I draw over A3 or generally A3. But then I'm zooming in to stuff. And I can spend a day on one panel. I won't tell you that I think a double page spread for Indigo Prime I did with the festival at the end of the universe. So big festival picture. I won't tell you how long that took. Ridiculous amount of time. But no, it's not, now I've stopped over-rendering things. It's picked up a bit. But now I'm just spending my time drawing instead. So the time I've saved rendering, I've put back into the drawing, I think, so the drawing's actually more detailed. I'm not like bothering, but no, I'm really bad for that time-wise. Yeah, I'm definitely not a Ron Smith. The timer, definitely that's not me. It's not looking good. Generally, I don't want to send it out, but yeah. You still there?
Yeah, still there.
Got a bit wobbly. Just got a bit wobbly while I rearranged the power.
All right. Because new series Evangelica started.
Yeah.
You've gone over. There you go.
You're back again. Right. There you go. I do this in the car when I'm trying to drive. Okay, just, yeah, we've got the sat nav on and I think you fall for. I need to get
So yeah, you've started the new series of Angelic, and I think the Meg Christmas cover is yours.
That's right, yeah, it was your first cover, that.
Was it?
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? I can't believe it's my first cover.
He's gone over again. So shocked he fell over.
Balance is there, right? Yeah, first cover. I've done a few covers over the years.
Yeah,
never for 2000. Oh. That the Rogue Trooper strip. I think we used the spiral page, the page where Rogue Trooper's falling down a spiral. I think we used that for a cover for the Rogue Trooper loot box special.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
So technically, that was the first cover, but technically, it wasn't the cover. So I don't count it. But yeah, it was nice to be asked. I'd like to do more covers, actually. Yeah, nice to do. Because it's done. You've done in a day. Well, generally in a day. But probably about as much work goes into one panel as a cover. You know what I mean? So if you've got like...
Well, this is the thing that... talking to various artists over the years, particularly those who haven't gone into comics.
Yeah.
You know, are very good. And people always say, when are you going to start doing comics? And the response is always, well, I'll put as much work into one page as 6 spot illustrations, each of which I'll get paid more than the whole page of comics would net me. Does that make comics economical for you? Or is, you know, what's the motivation to keep doing them when, you know, it's not as if you've not worked in other industries as well?
Yeah, I think it's just I always love the comics. I think it's just a story. It's the same reason why I'm probably not tempted to be just a cover artist. I like drawing. I think it's where it basically comes down to. I like drawing stuff that I like drawing. So it's fun to draw. I really don't mind drawing 120 pages of it. I think it's what my partner would kick me for this, but yeah, I'm probably not the best person to be sensible when it comes to monetary situations. Because technically, I should really get back in the games industry because that's where the money is, and obviously the industry is massive there. But it's, yeah, I've always been, I think 2008 is a massive influence. And so it's always, I've even found it with other jobs that I probably never get hired by another company. 2008 always gets an extra 10%. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So if I'm given 100%, 2008 get 110%. Does that make sense?
Yeah, just for that
childhood. Yeah. That childhood, because it was 2008 that made me want to be an artist. That and the choice of other jobs in Hartlepool. So being a comic artist seemed like a good idea. And it was 2008 that sort of guided me through teenage life. Do you know what I mean? Rather than being all about being in trouble or as teenagers do, 2008 was always a constant something to aim for. So I am lost now because that was my aim to draw Judge Dredd. and I did that a few years ago now, so I've just been wandering the wilds, not knowing what to do with myself. Just happy to work for 2008, even as the work comes. But yeah, I need to find myself a new goal, because as the Judge Dredd was my goal when I was a child, to draw Judge Dredd for 2018. And now I have no clue what my next goal should be. And I feel I need one.
I mean, that's not an enviable position to be in, really, is it, as an artist?
Oh, no, it's really, it's been a bit awesome, right? It's been quite nice. I've been really lucky. I've been doing it since I was 16. Since I was 16, I've been doing it full time for 30 years, 31 years, which is quite a strange thing. I've never had a normal job, apart from the Bizarre Creations job. But I don't count that as a normal job. Because it was so, like, to me, a normal job is somewhere you go where you don't particularly want to be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's other things you could be doing, you'd rather do, and you're just doing your job to pay your bills. Whereas Bizarre Creations wasn't. It was never considered the pain to go there. Or again, I was just drawing and creating. Like 3Ds, like Lego. It's just like, if someone gives you a 3D job to do, it's just like playing Lego for the day. So I've been really lucky in terms of the last 30 years of getting to do interesting things.
I guess that kind of answers my what was to be my final question, which is what's next. You know, you've got Angelic, you've done your first cover for 2000 AD.
Yeah.
Is it one of those things that you're in a fortunate enough position that you can just go, well, what comes up, what is what comes up, or is it something that's causing you any anxiety?
You know, it's weird. It's been quite a few years since I've been full time freelance. 10 years, I think, full time freelance. And the most scary thing is my speed. It's not a lack of work, because I've never not had work to do. So I think I've had two occasions in 10 years where I've panicked and thought, oh, work. One was, I'd literally finished a job for 2008 just before Christmas. And so, but that was fantastic. It meant I had a week without no work to do, but it was over Christmas, so I didn't worry. And didn't think about it. It was like ideal. I mean, I could take a week off for Christmas, not worry about deadline. And then sure enough, I think I was waiting on a script. So there was work coming and that came, and obviously in the new year, so I started work again. I had a few months ago, I mean, about a couple of hours at work, and the panic kicked in. And then you start offering up commissions, private commissions, and then it's about 2 or 3 days later, you get a script bottle popping or some work from a computer game thing popping. So work is coming in. It's just getting done at a quick enough speed, making it sort of worthwhile industry to be in. You know what I mean? But yeah, it's all about getting it done on time. But it's hard when you're enjoying something and you don't want to send it off. You can't have it yet. But yeah, definitely don't take as much time on comics. It's going to make a difference. Speed it a bit.
Well, it just occurred to me that there was one question I wanted to ask. It was about one thing that's always struck me, and this is just an adjunct to a question I asked like an hour ago, is equipment. Like all your hardware and like military equipment seems spot on. And I wanted to ask whether you're obsessed with military hardware or whether this is just a consequence of working in games.
Probably a consequence of working in games. Trying to think how, which in what particular way. Yeah, I'm not a gun fanatic by any means. I don't think I've got any weird things like or anything like that really. I think it's just making sure it's referenced or created. I don't know. I've certainly got no gun fetishes.
Well, it's,
I have got, though. I've got a few dodgy airsoft weapons, which I probably should hand in. These are all given and bought before the law came in, where they're all brightly coloured.
Okay.
So you used to have to go to the shops and buy AK-47. And it was just an airsoft gun, but it looked like an AK. Whereas now I think they're all bright yellows and blues and pinks.
Right, yeah.
Whereas obviously when I got it, it was pretty realistic looking. I'm not quite sure what to do with them. I'm not sure if we should hand them in.
don't be waving them around, let's put that way.
Matthew, I'm waving them around. I do reference photography in the garden sometimes, setting the camera on a timer and going to do a pose or whatever. And that's embarrassing because your neighbours are all watching. What the hell is he up to?
I mean, could this be the last interview with Lee Carter before he appears on the front of the local paper?
Oh, I wouldn't do it for airsoft gun, I tell you. I would not sit in the garden with an airsoft gun. I stick to the Nerf guns when it comes to the outside photography. I think that's... I need to get rid of them, actually. Anybody need an airsoft gun? AK-47? Bazooka?
Is it, at least you're not doing like war comics with Garth Ennis, like PJ Holden has to do, where you've got to look up a lot of Nazi weaponry, etc., etc.
I can't imagine these Google searches, mate. Google search must be quite bad.
Well, thanks so much to Lee for that. I hope you enjoyed that, Flitz. Looking forward to seeing how the new series of Angelic develops over the coming months. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time for our last episode of the year. We're going to take a bit of a break over Christmas and New Year. Don't forget that this Christmas tide, you can spread the joy of Thrill Power by giving them a gift voucher to a subscription for 2080, available in monthly, annual, 2-year subscription option. So, spread the love at this time of year. Hope you are staying well, Earthlets. We shall be back, and I hope you are all taking care of each other, particularly dicey time. But until once again, we pop back into your ears, broadcasting from the 2080 Nerve Center. Splendid Berthrig.
Alert! 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 Thrill power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! The 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.